session number 13856, reel 3.
Right, three. That's marvelous. Yes, Monsieur Chiappe. Well, we only assumed it was Monsieur Chiappe. I can only say that Lieutenant Split Bill Talio was the flight commander, and I was his wingman. And we were patrolling somewhere south of Marseille, really showing the flag. And Bill spotted a float plane. Well, it had definitely wasn't Spanish, definitely it wasn't Italian, so it could only, I reckon, be French, although it hadn't got French colours on it. Anyway, he had a go at it, and it didn't pay much attention, so I said, well, I didn't think this was a proper target for war, because it, who knows who it is. So I dived down, and it blew up, or crashed into the sea. And I took its number on its tailplane before it sank. There's no survivors. And when we got back on board, we reported this strange-looking aeroplane, because they'd warned everybody. Everybody should keep clear of the fleet because it was dangerous to come near the fleet. Well, how in the hell should they know where the fleet was? Because we kept that as pretty close secret. I was then put under pretty intense interrogation. I don't know what had been done. I was told to say nothing and never forget and forget all about it. And I couldn't understand, except for the fact we might have shot down a civilian sort of aircraft, which might have had some consequences. Anyway, they sent a destroyer off to the spot where we'd shot it down. And when it got there, the story runs, I mean, this is, again, nobody said anything much, but we heard that there had been thousands of English pound notes floating in the water. And I don't know whether an English pound note of those days, whatever they had for pound notes, whether they floated or not. I never threw one away to find whether they could last on the surface. But anyway, the story was that it was thousands and thousands of pound notes floating about on the sea. And shortly afterwards, it was also reported that through the intelligence network that Monsieur Chiappe had disappeared on his flight to Syria. Because in that, if you remember, at that stage of the war, Syria, which was French Syria, and the British had just moved in to occupy the whole of Syria, as to prevent the French from stirring up, you know, Vichy and Pétain and all that, Laval, were pretty hostile to the Brits. So one assumes that this was Monsieur Chiappe going with British pound notes to suborn the citizens in Syria. I'd love to know whether there was any truth in that, but that's the story. That's how he met his end, or that aircraft met his end anyway.
Who was Rupert Watson?
Yes, Rupert Watson, what a lovely man. Lieutenant Rupert Watson. His wife was killed in the German attack on London, where they blew up the Café de Paris nightclub, if you remember that place. And the bomb went down and blew. His wife was down there. And he joined the squadron after Tillard was killed. Have I told you about the death of Tillard? We had Drunkie Lewin take over from him, and he brought with him Rupert Watson, who it was a lovely chap, but of course he was seething with rage about losing his wife, whom he loved very much, and he only wanted to shoot at the Germans. Anyway, poor old Rupert, he did so much. I reckon he had a great influence on getting me promoted or get him medals and things like that, because he was a very good friend. He, on one of these Malta convoys where we had the Duke of Howe, the Duke of York, all these great blunderbusses of battleships plying through, Watson was leading his flight of three with their wheels and flaps down, landing on. We were into wind. They were going down on the downwind leg, wheels and flaps down, and hooked down, ready to land on. And this battleship opened up with their Chicago pianos, if you know what I mean, the multiple pom-poms. And they shot the whole lot down. And Rupert died by British guns and his crew. And another crew were eliminated, and the third lot were picked up. It didn't endear us to the battleship brigade. I can remember after Hooky Holland had resigned on board ship, he couldn't stand the strain. Hooky Holland had been through all the Oran diplomatic business in the earlier 40s, and he announced somewhere at sea that he had going to relinquish command, and Mourne took over. L.E.H. Mourne. I'm trying to remember now why I mentioned that.
You were talking about in connection with your attitude towards the battleships.
Yes. Yes. I'd have to pause here while I try to recollect. You see, I do not wish to say too much against the battleships. It was the battleship. Oh, yes, I know what I was trying to say was that it was mourned when I was on the flight deck or in the bridge when I had just landed on. I'll go back to why I was ashore, but I had just landed on. I had a flight of three Fulmers in those days, and I'd landed on, and I went up to talk to report to the captain and on the bridge, and I watched my next number two land on. That was all right, and then number three landed on, and the captain then turned to me and he said, "Hey, well done," he said. "That makes 12 fighters, and if one of them had failed or had crashed, we would not be going on this Malta convoy because it couldn't risk a carrier with less than 12 fighters to defend it." So I didn't know whether to cheer or be rather sad because we weren't keen on those Malta convoys. But when this battleship then shoots down a quarter of your complement gratuitously, you can imagine the emotion I'd say hatred, because of course you can't hate them, but disgust. The attitude, I don't like to say too much, but it is very emotional, the conflict between the deep-seated seamen of the Nelson era, where close-quarter gunnery and fight it out and painting the gun decks red so you don't get frightened with all the blood and the mess and so on. It's a bit out of date. And they were so proud of their great big guns, 16 inches and 15 inches. They were fine for impressing the African natives, thinking they were like virile male symbols, you see. And yet, he came to the war. You see, we'd already... Well, I haven't got as far as Bismarck. Oh, gosh. I better wait until we get through Bismarck first before I continue about this awful conflict between the air and the gunnery branch of the sea. Because they could never forget. They never really learnt the lessons of Jutland. They couldn't bear Taranto, of course. That was the... the iron entered their soul. They wanted to write down Taranto. And then, of course, ultimately, they wrote down Palembang, because that was an even more significant development of sea power, which they didn't want to have thrust upon them, because it destroyed the heart, what they thought was the heart of the Navy, i.e. the battleship. Because they hadn't yet realized that the battleship was already outdated.
We'll pick up this theme of the tensions between sea and air later, but you mentioned the Italian Duke you talked to. Did you speak to any other Italian captured pilots?
Oh, yeah. I shot down if this is the event that... I was shot down at Camp 506, somewhere in the middle of 1941, and it shot him down in the water. And it was lurchy, he was sort of sinking quietly in the water, and there was no sign of life on board. And I said, well, either I've shot them all dead, or they're playing monkeys or something. Anyway, the thing was sinking, so I said, well, I'll let them be. My rear gunner, once again, of course, in those in the Fulmer, we had... The chap in the back had a K-gun, you know, sort of a handheld automatic chap, and he was giving it the squirt. I said, oh, let them be. I said, they're about 50 miles offshore, and God knows where, and with warm sea, but it's a long way for anybody to paddle, and it's bad enough if you're wounded. And so I'd circle around two or three times, and there's no sign of anybody moving, so... they'd have an awful lot of rowing to do. So I went back to the ship. And I thought that was that. It wasn't until 1965 or something, when I was in a NATO appointment, SINC-AFMED appointment in Izmir, that there was a visiting delegation of Italian Air Force. And I was talking to one of the chaps, a colonel. I said, well, you're old enough to have been in the last war. And he said, oh, CC, and all that. So I said, well, what were you doing? He said, well, I was flying aircraft, reconnaissance aircraft. I said, whereabouts? In the Mediterranean. Well, I have described this before. But so I said, how very interesting. Well, he said, it wasn't too interesting. We were always hunting for the British carriers, you see, to find them. And then some wretched fellow came and shot me down in the sea. I said, well, what month? He said, it was about July. I said, really? At about 2:30 in the afternoon or 3? He said, yes. I said, and you lay on the water, we're lying doggo inside. Yes, he said, we did. We thought they were going to shoot at us, but they didn't. So I said, well, I think you were the chap I must have shot down. And it was very interesting. I don't think he was...
Were there any hard feelings?
Yes. I don't think he was at all pleased. I think he must have thought I ought to have been at least an admiral worthy enough to shoot him down. He was only a colonel. Well, I was only a commander then. By that time I transferred to the Navy. However, it was a nice thought to think that he'd gone on.
It seems that you had a compassionate attitude towards the people that you shot down.
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's like the RNLI. I mean, I always subscribe to them. One day I'm going to need them. And one day I'm going to get shot down. I'm going to need a little bit of compassion, too. It's bad enough being shot down, but then the business of survival is another thing. At any time I objected to that was when I was in the Far East with the Japanese war, and I by that time I was air coordinator, or in command in the air of all four carriers, and I issued my edict, and I said, is there any chance of a Jap ever regaining his base, whether he's on the end of a parachute or anything? I said, you just shoot him. For the Japs had cut the heads off my friends, I see that there should not have enough Japs left to do any more cuttings off. However, that's the only time I started to change my attitude. I have no great love for the Japanese as a result of that rather barbarous treatment. Bushido.
Can you tell me about your flight to Pantelleria from Malta? To Malta via Pantelleria?
Well, yes, we used to reinforce Malta with Spitfires and Hurricanes, and we were doing a trip. And the Illustrious had got rather short of aircraft. Well, Illustrious was at the what they call the men's end before she was suffered her final damage, where she was towed back, made her way, ran through the canal right back to America for a refit. They wanted a flight, and Spit Bill Taylor and I tossed up in the wardroom who was to go. It was either his flight or mine, because I was a flight commander by that time. And I won, so I took off from Lark and flew. And I thought on the way from Ark to Malta, and I can't understand why people found it difficult to navigate in the Mediterranean. I mean, there's land on your port side, there's land on your starboard side, as long as you're flying east or west. It's not very difficult. And in any case, exterior compass course is not difficult either. And there was Pantelleria. Well, Pantelleria, we'd known, was a small fort, fortified island. And while I was there, I said, well, I had myself and two others, you see. So we went and did a snoop. We didn't actually beat the place up. We strolled over it and had a look around and went on. And, of course, we landed at Halfa in Malta. And when I went and reported that I'd arrived, here were the aeroplanes, and when was I to join the Illustrious, they said, oh, no, you've got to report back to headquarters in Grand Harbour. And there I was met by some air commode, and he said, were you flying over Pantelleria? I said, yes, of course. And he said, I have a good mind to have you court-martialed, he said. I said, why? I said, I'm doing a reconnaissance. Was it in your orders to do it? And I said, well, it doesn't need. I use my own judgment. I said, I'm passing by. I might as well have a look and tell you what's going on. And they said, well, you stirred up the hornet's nest, and all the fighters took off, and there was a Sunderland coming through with some VIP on. They all got messed up. I'm very sorry about that. I said, nobody bothered to tell me about that, and I didn't tell you about what I'd done either. I mean, war has its chances. But that was life. And in any case, they didn't want myself or my men. All we had to do was dump our aeroplanes at Halfa. The Illustrious took them over. We went back to our old hideouts, and I caught a destroyer back to Jib with my merry men. It was all fun going back by night through the minefields, 25 knots, moonlight night. Beautiful. What a relief. So I rejoined Ark after that little visit to Malta.
What was the air defense at the North Front?
Of the?
North Front.
Yeah. There'd been in Jib. As a result of Iran, if you recall, when the French battleships refused to surrender or come out or be neutralized or join the British, the bombardment, and of course there are a lot of hard feelings, it was not very nice. The whole of that Iran episode was bad news. So that when that the Force H was assembled in Gibraltar, The enraged Frenchmen sent over the Martin Marylands with bombs on, and they dropped. They did one or two sorties over the rock. Of course, the rock anti-aircraft fire, but then, of course, anti-aircraft fire never hits the targets they intend to have. They only hit your own side. So they decided that they need some air defense. Well, lucky Joe, who got it? I did. I took my flight ashore to North Front, where we landed. I had three Fulmers, and for about 3 weeks we were there. We were the air defense of Jib. We had no very good information, radar or warning. It doesn't matter. We used to be at 10 minutes notice or something like that. Scramble, all very good stuff. But it wasn't really quite like that. We'd established a lovely little mess. It was very cheap. Gin was only about half a crown a bottle or something. And and I used to waffle around. It was great fun, actually, flying around here. And we used to give a lot of encouragement to the troops, the poor old chaps who were there to defend Jib against aggression. But we never, we did patrols and so on, but we never met any Frenchmen. So after 3 weeks, they decided the threat had vanished. Anyway, I felt it was rather fun being responsible for the air defense of Gibraltar for 3 weeks.
What about the apes on the rock?
Oh, yes. Well, the living in a carrier for a long time, there's always fans, noises. There's noises all the time. Clank, bang, wallops of saucers, things, and chunking noises. But above all, the roaring of fans and the whining of machinery. And I got to know the coastal gunner, the head of the gunnery defenses of Gibraltar. It was a cap called Captain Prattley, and he lived in a farm. I'm trying to remember its name and I keep forgetting it. Anyway, he lived in a beautiful old farmhouse in ancient Jib days, and he was also, amongst his other duties, was keeper of the king's apes. Of course, it was the king's apes in those days. It was George VI. And I got very friendly with him, and I said, you know, it would be tremendous for me to sleep ashore without any noise at all. And I got permission from my captain. I was allowed to go and spend a couple of nights during one of our off periods. But he said, you're still at 4 hours' notice. Well, he had a telephone, I think it was fair enough. And of course, I always regard that as one of the things that saved my sanity, because you go a bit berserk after half time. But to spend 48 hours in peaceful quiet was wonderful. I shall never thank him enough.
Now, can we go on to the hunt for the Bismarck, please? What are your personal memories about that?
Yes, the Bismarck. The tragedy of the Bismarck. Of course, the Hood. I think the Hood was entirely the fault of their lordships. She was a light battleship, battle cruiser, flimsily armored, but they seemed to have learned no lessons from the Battle of Jutland, which of course was an ignominious defeat of British technology in ships, where they blew up one after another. The Germans virtually survived. I know a lot of some of them did sink, but not in any comparable rate. And you'd have thought that all this tremendous keenness about gunnery officers being the only way for promotion in the Navy institutes some sort of insulated layer of intelligence between common sense. And they didn't seem to have either when it came to the reorganization of their battleships against these businesses. And with one salvo, of course, or whatever it was, I wouldn't argue about how many shells actually landed on the Hood. What happens, she just blows up, her magazines blow up. It's not as though it wasn't just the Hood. It was also the Barham in the Mediterranean had a similar disastrous thing. The whole ship blew apart in a minute and a half. Well, you can't tell me that. And when, in due course, Tovey made that CNC home fleet in the Bismarck action signal that he was unable to sink Bismarck by gunfire, it rings a bit hollow in my ears that here we had the Hood blow up in within 7 minutes of engagement, and then we had the Barham blow up with one lucky landed torpedo or bomb or something, I can't remember, but that blew up in even 30 seconds. So we can sink a British ship in 30 seconds, but we can't sink the Bismarck with the whole arrangements of battleships and everything pounding their shells in. If something was wrong, and that is what disturbed me so much. At the beginning of the Bismarck business, when the Hood blew up, well, also other arguments, that all that eagerness of being Nelson and getting into the kill, And he steered straight for Bismarck, which meant only his A and B turrets, the forward turrets, could bear. If he'd done on a sort of a gradually converging course, reducing the range, he could have had his X and Y turrets. That's if he'd double the amount of guns firing. But anyway, the way he did. And he also had, Prince of Wales in tow, who was just early learning how to work its guns. And they were all stationed in such close order, I think they had 400 yards between two cables, between ships and something, whereas you'd have thought that if there's going to be any overs or misses of ship A, if you've got another one within the vicinity, the chances are it's going to hit ship B, which is actually what happened. These were errors in comprehension, and that's not my side of the business. Mine is the air business. But this is gunnery, and you'd have thought any common sense dispersal. God's truth, we learned about dispersing our aircraft. But did they disperse their ships in an attack formation? Within reason, anyway. So that pretty upset us. I mean, everybody was shocked by the loss of the Hood. But as a result, of course, the Navy went into absolute panic, because Hood's sister ship was Renown. Renown was our beloved Admiral Somerville, who had more sense than any of these other admirals, and he was sent. He received a signal. So under no circumstance was he to attempt to engage Bismarck. Under no circumstances. What a signal to send! What a commission, an admission of total failure by the gunnery world, that they had to deny even a captain, proud captain of a ship, to engage the enemy. It runs contrary to all the spirits that we know. However, they were so terrified of this awful display with Jutland in the background and Hood then coming to the front. To have a third one would have been just too much. So Renown was ordered under no circumstances to engage the Bismarck. Well, there we arrived. Now, we hadn't been called out until the last desperate minute, because Victorious had tried to have a go, you know, and they were very brave, and they did reconnaissance, and they did an attack, but it didn't have too much effect. Bismarck still steamed on. Well, it was all finished in the end. There was no hope of stopping Bismarck. She was steaming 25 knots per breast. Well, she was not far off. So we were yanked out of jib in the usual way. Sent up north, then the errors started repeating themselves, you see. The flagship in Nelson, really, I think it was Nelson, which I'm almost sure it was Nelson, which it was Davy's ship, it was one of those anyways, Nelson, Renan, Rodney.
Probably Rodney.
The whole gang of them up there, and a few of the slower ones too was hanging about. Failed to inform the Force H, because Somerville knew his onions backwards and was certainly passed it to Ark Royal. Anyway, the message never got to Ark Royal, wherever it may have never been originated, that the signal was that there were no friendly ships within 30 miles, or was it 50 miles, of Bismarck. What he had not omitted to mention, or what had not been sent, was that CNC Home Fleet had detailed Sheffield to shadow the Bismarck. Of course, Sheffield had got radar by that time, some sort of radar. Sheffield was within 20, 25.